Well, we have been continuing our study of the Gospel of John, and we have been working our way through John chapter 7, and we have seen after spending some time in Galilee, Jesus and his disciples went up to Jerusalem for the feast. This was after he had given the Bread of Life discourse in chapter 6, where he mentioned several times that he had come down from heaven, which meant he had come down from God. That means he was indicating something of himself that was different and unusual compared to other people, which they should have been picking up. This was also after the discussion with his brothers, who encouraged him to go up to the feast to bolster his support from his followers. They were encouraging him to capitalize on the growing popularity that he was gaining, and that he should go there and continue to grow his support. And we have noted that they were making this recommendation for him to continue making a name for himself, but not because they believed in him, at least not at this point. Which we saw as a reminder that even those closest to Jesus did not believe in him. But Jesus did eventually go up to the feast when the time was right, after his brothers had departed. We had also noted some mixed reviews that Jesus was getting even before he made himself known at the feast. So people were talking about him before he went up there. There was some grumbling among them, not in front of the leaders, but behind the scenes, as to whether Jesus was good or whether he was a deceiver. And then in the middle of the feast, he went up to the temple and he taught the people. And this stimulated some questions about his training and his authority. And he responded, indicating that he was only bringing glory to the one who had sent him. That's something he had referred to various times before, and it was because it was righteous for him to do so. And we continue to see at various occasions, as John is communicating, that people did not understand who he was. As a matter of fact, it took, after Jesus died, it took about 400 years of the church trying to work through exactly who he is, and they came up with the understanding of his hypostatic union, trying to figure out, is he God, is he man, how does that all fit together? And so it's not surprising that they had some difficulty there, but they did not really understand exactly who he was or why he was there. And so one of the things that we want to consider as we continue looking at the text, as we look at verses 19 through 21, is that people make judgments regarding what they hear. And as we'll see here in the passage, it's going to lead up to more discussion about the matter of making judgments, but Jesus is responding to what they had been talking about before, and so he says this in verse 19, "Did not Moses give you the law, yet none of you keeps the law? Why do you seek to kill me?" The people answered and said, "You have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you?" Jesus answered and said to them, "I did one work and you all marvel." Now we kind of get the feeling that there's probably more to all of this, and we'll see there is some, because this is kind of a small snippet of probably what all had transpired. But what we want to recognize is some people make judgments from faulty understanding. And Jesus provided a contrast between himself and the Jews. Jesus had just claimed that God had given him his teaching and that he proclaimed it faithfully, and he did so as a righteous man. And now he's contrasting his critics with himself. They claim that Moses had given them their teaching that they were utilizing, and they did not carry it out faithfully as righteous men. So he's contrasting with them. And so it would be incongruous for them to seek to kill Jesus. But some of them had been before and would again. They accused him essentially of unrighteousness, but they were actually the ones who were not following through with what they understood they should be doing. They were the unrighteous ones. And so some of them were seeking to kill him, even though Moses had taught that it's not God's will to kill people. So they were not following through that for sure. So obviously they had not submitted to God's will when it came through Moses. And it's no wonder they failed to understand Jesus' teaching, which also came from God, and that's what he's trying to communicate to them. Many of Jesus' hearers didn't realize the depth of the animosity of Israel's leaders toward him. They naively thought he was crazy to think someone was trying to kill him. And what we need to recognize is that the Jews of Jesus' day commonly thought of mental illness as being demon-induced. In this case, they were thinking that he was just being paranoid, and so they would make that association. That was not uncommon, still is in some parts of the world. And so there are other references to Jesus having a demon, and in this case, it's not that they are saying that Jesus is getting his power from Satan as they did in another context, looking at Matthew 9 and 10 and 12 and Mark 3 and Luke 11 and Matthew 11. All of these have those kinds of occasions. But they were simply associating his response as a demonically induced kind of thinking. The one deed that is in view here, this one work, ergon work, that Jesus had done referred to a miraculous work, and it's evidently referring back to the healing of the paralytic at the pool of Bethesda in John chapter 5, and it had caused all who heard about it to marvel, John 5, 10 through 18, and it had started a controversy about Jesus in Jerusalem. Because remember, Jesus had been in Jerusalem, and then he had left and gone to Galilee, and then he came back to Jerusalem again. But there were still people talking about it. It was still a significant impact on people. And so this was no small matter in their minds. And sometimes it's not easy for us to see how they would have thought about things, but it probably was a greater impact than what we may even realize, particularly if you had been there and had seen it take place. It certainly had stirred up some discussion and some question as to who he is and how was he able to do that. And it would have gotten people's attention. And it certainly did that, and now it's stimulating their curiosity and their marveling and so on. Then looking at verses 22 to 24, we read, Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, because it predated Moses. And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. So he's asking them to think more carefully through what they are accusing him of in light of what they make allowances for. Some people show evidence of inconsistency. That is an understatement, of all understatements, perhaps. He provided an illustration of their inconsistency. This work of Jesus in healing the paralytic was likely symbolizing God's desire for physical wholeness. The act of circumcision would have been understood as having physical benefits as well as ceremonial significance. Looking back to Leviticus 12:3, The Jews recognized this, and consequently they circumcised male infants on the eighth day following their births, even if that day was a Sabbath. So they were meticulous about following at least this aspect of it, but other things they might not quite be so consistently following. But we know that normally the Jews were very careful not to do work on the Sabbath, but on this occasion they would do what might have been considered work otherwise. And so Jesus has a parenthetic reference here to circumcision that points out that it really goes back to the patriarchs, to the time of Abraham, and then was followed through from that. And perhaps even in the process, it is a slight deprecation of Moses to say, this isn't everything that you think it is. It's not really Moses anyway. It goes back to what God's expectations are. And they needed to recognize that. And therefore, Jesus is saying, what I'm doing is from God, and what Moses doing was from God, and what Abraham was doing was from God. And you need to look further back than just Moses. The critics of Jesus had claimed to follow Moses faithfully, but in following that circumcision law, they were not so much following Moses as going all the way back to Abraham, Genesis 17. And so technically we would understand that Moses incorporated the circumcision law into the Mosaic code by God's instruction due to a previous obligation that the people had who were in a covenant relationship with their God. And again, the point is that this act predated Moses in authority and significance, and it required the suspension of one law in order to keep another. And we had talked about in our Sunday school class on ethics about the hierarchical situation, and there's more that we'll be dealing with on that. This meant the Sabbath requirement was not the higher law, and therefore they should recognize that there could be provision for Jesus to do what he did. Jesus' critics permitted an act on the Sabbath that resulted in a specific benefit for an infant on the Sabbath, and therefore they should not object to his healing a whole adult, the entire man, on the same day. And besides, they perform circumcisions regularly on the Sabbath because you never know when a child is going to be born and whatever the eighth day is after that. But Jesus had only healed one man on one particular Sabbath, and therefore, he's trying to put some perspective on the matter there. And in addition, there was the contrast of a purification rite with the healing of a man who had been lame for 38 years. So it was unfair for Jesus' critics to be angry with him for what he had done. That's what he's essentially trying to communicate there. Jesus concluded by warning his hearers against judging according to appearances or superficiality. There are various passages in the Old Testament that touch on this. Deuteronomy 16, 18 to 19, Isaiah 11, 3 to 4, Zechariah 7 to 9. Their superficial judgment about what was legitimate activity on the Sabbath had resulted in superficial judgment about Jesus' work and his person. And he told them to stop doing that. Don't be acting or thinking that way. He was doing a good thing for a person who was in need, and therefore that would take priority. And they needed to make judgments on the basis of a righteous criteria and not just following some prescription without giving consideration to the larger context. And we could learn from this admonition as well. In our making of judgments, we need to determine, are we consistent and true according to Scripture and not just selectively following things as it seems desirable or preferential on a given occasion. So now the discussion is going to take another turn with some additional input. People commonly misunderstand Jesus' identity. Again, another understatement here. Now, some of them from Jerusalem said, "Is this not he whom they seek to kill? And notice it says some of them from Jerusalem. That's indicating it's a contrast to some others who weren't from Jerusalem, but who were visiting there because they were there because of the feast. But look, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? However, we know that where this man is from, but when the Christ comes, no one knows where he is from. Is that true, or is that a misunderstanding on their part? There was lingering confusion regarding Jesus' origin. That's been referenced before, and it will continue to be a bit of a challenge for the people here. The locals from Jerusalem were familiar with rising animosity because they had seen it, because they were close to the center of things. They were seeing what the elders, the leaders, the Sanhedrin, and so on. But many of the Jewish pilgrims that were in the temple courtyard where Jesus was speaking, because they were there gathered for the special occasions, they didn't realize how antagonistic the religious leaders were to Jesus. But the locals who had been around when there wasn't as much activity, they had seen what was going on, because when Jesus had been there before for the event that he had referenced earlier about healing the man at the pool. And they were basically marveling that Jesus was speaking out publicly and that the authorities were not directly opposing him. They spoke against him, but they weren't stopping him. And therefore, they made some assumptions on that basis. And they assumed that if Jesus were a deceiver, the rulers would lock him up. But if he was the Messiah, they would acknowledge him as such. And they were kind of wondering, okay, which way is this thing going to go? But the authorities, we are told, did not do what they wanted, that is to lock him up, because they feared the people, because they had a sense of this crowd mentality, and we know what can happen there. We've heard what had just recently happened in another part of the world with a crowd of people getting killed. So the situation led some of the locals to suspect that maybe the leaders might actually believe. Or at least they could, or maybe even should, recognize that Jesus was the Messiah, the promised one. But the people of Jerusalem were skeptical that Jesus was the Messiah. They had more questions about it, because they had ideas of what the Messiah should look like. They believed that their human Messiah would have to fit certain parameters, certain qualifications. And they had been under the understanding that his origins would be unknown. That was a familiar tradition at the time, but it was faulty. And there are other places where they recognize that his birthplace should be Bethlehem. Micah 5:2 seems quite clear. And it's going to be referenced. The common understanding of Jesus' origin was that he was known to have grown up in Nazareth, and that they assumed he was born there. And they couldn't go to the clerk's office and look up to see his birth certificate, because I don't think they had those back then. So that would have been difficult to pull off. And not only did they failed to perceive his heavenly origin, but they were not even correct on his earthly origin. And so they had misunderstanding there as well. So they didn't really know him all that well, or as well as they maybe thought they did. And many today don't know him all that well either, because they haven't taken the time to look into who he is. Or they have discounted him before finding out just whether or not the things that have been written about him are true. Looking at verses 28 and 29, then Jesus cried out as he taught in the temple, saying, "You both know me, and you know where I'm from." Or perhaps we could say, at least you should. But they did not act ultimately as if they did. And I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. But I know him, for I am from him, and he sent me. Now, how many times, I didn't actually go through and count how many times up to this point in the Gospel of John has he indicated where he is from, that he's come from the Father. But that's been very strongly communicated in John's Gospel. So there was lingering confusion regarding Jesus' identity. And we have to admit, it's not surprising that people had difficulty understanding Jesus' nature and his identity. As we had noted, it took the church a while to come to terms with exactly who he is as well. But Jesus indicated that they should have some familiarity with him because he had been around. He had been open to communicate with them. He had told him things about himself. It's also noteworthy here that when John describes Jesus as crying out in a particular context, it's usually indicating an important public announcement that he is making, something that they need to take note of. And Jesus said that his hearers did know him and where he was from. At least they should have. They should have known his earthly origin. It was not a secret, but it might not have been as obvious. And he had told them many times about his heavenly origin. So he had both the earthly origin and the heavenly origin that he had indicated. But whatever knowledge they may have had of him was apparently only superficial. And they could have known his earthly origin if they had pursued it further, instead of just going with their assumptions. Now, we are in danger of making assumptions, are we not? And not checking things out to the degree that we could or should, so we can understand and appreciate how that happens. But Jesus, again, referred to his heavenly origin, and he pointed out that he was sent from God, and that they did not know the one who sent him, at least not personally. They should have. But Jesus did know him, and he knew him directly and intimately as his Father. This was because he had come from the Father, and he recognized and he indicated that he was true or he was real, and this relationship was real. And so Jesus meant that God the Father really had sent him, regardless of what others might think about his origins. Unfortunately, they didn't know the one who had sent him, at least not in the way that they should have. And so they had a superficial recognition, but not a personal recognition, not a personal trust, not a heart response that the Old Testament as well as the New Testament frequently references as critical. They did not know God because they didn't really know the Scriptures. They didn't take up to themselves what the Scriptures were saying, that there was an expectation to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And they ended up following the externals rather than the internal expectation. And that's a danger that people have today and still fall into that trap. But once again, what we want to recognize here is what is John communicating in the process as he's recording the events that are taking place here. He's again pointing out that Christ is God, coming from the Father. He's not simply born into the world like any other human, but he was sent to earth from his Father, which suggests, as he indicates very clearly in John chapter 1, that he had an existence prior to coming into this world. He took on human flesh and dwelt among us. And that's what he's again coming back to. Then looking at verses 30 and 31, therefore they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. And many of the people believed in him and said, when the Christ comes, will he do more signs than these which this man has done? other words, can you imagine anybody else doing any more than he's already done? So there were strongly opposite responses to Jesus' words. And as we are well aware, that is still the case today. People will either accept or reject, and usually it is strong in either direction. So there were some who were inclined to take Jesus by force. Evidently, those Jews who intended to seize Jesus wanted to restrain him. They wanted to put an end to what they would perceive as delusional deceptions, but they were not able to do that because his hour had not come. And in this case, the word hour there is ora. It's referring to the ultimate sacrifice for sin that is anticipated in the future. That hour had not yet come. And so in some way, they were prevented from taking him or arresting him at this point. But some were inclined to believe in him. And it even indicates many from the multitude actually believed in him. And so Jesus' presence provoked a division among the hearers, as has been the case on almost every occasion, and is the case on almost every occasion that continues today. Some respond and some don't. Some reject outright, others accept, and then there are some who vacillate in between for a time. These seem to have believed because of the signs that had been performed. That was kind of indicated. Who can do these things unless it's the Messiah? That may not be a particularly strong basis for faith, but they apparently concluded that this could be, maybe must be, the Messiah because they couldn't imagine anybody else who would fit that qualification. Because they were also anticipating a human deliverer, a political person. And so there was some tension in their response to some degree. But there probably were not that many at this point that were really recognizing Jesus as God incarnate. And John is trying to indicate that that's what they should have been picking up, because that's what he understood as the gospel writer to be the case. That's what he is noting. That's what he tells us in John 20, verses 30 and 31, that he is the Christ. You need to believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God. Now, we also note that throughout this gospel, it's noted that it is better to believe on the basis of miracles than not to believe at all. And there's no particular condemnation giving for a faith that is based on that. It's not indicated as in some way inadequate if you recognize that Jesus is the Messiah, based on what they do understand, on the light they have at the present. Are they accepting and responding to that? We think about when a child believes, a four-year-old. Can a four-year-old trust Christ? Can they believe that Jesus died for their sins? Can they believe that they can have eternal life through him? They certainly can. I know of those who have. Do they have all of the content figured out yet? No, but it comes over time. And so we are reminded also of the value of the faith of a child. Matthew 18:3, Mark 10:15, Luke 18:17. And so this response of faith is as valuable as any other. And we need to recognize that as well. Also, some people demand much more validation. In come the Pharisees. The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him, and the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. Then Jesus said to them, "I shall be with you a little while longer, and then I go to him who sent me. You will seek me and not find me, and where I am you cannot come." And so the Pharisees and in conjunction with the chief priests, gathered up a posse to go get him, to bring him in, because they thought he'd been on the loose long enough. It's time to corral him, get him off the scene. He's disturbing the people. They're confused, and we don't want them to be confused by Jesus. We want them to be confused by us. No, that's not what they were saying. But there was some confusion regardless. Some people will have to face disappointment. Now, that's, again, a fairly broad statement, but it kind of helps us think through this just a little bit. Those in leadership were concerned about some believing, or verse 31 says many believing. The Pharisees had heard that some of the Jews present were voicing their belief that Jesus must be the Messiah, and these comments moved them to act immediately to arrest Jesus. They had had enough. So when the common people turned to Jesus, they turned away from the Pharisees. That was the problem. And they didn't adhere to their teachings. Together with the chief priests, who were mainly the Sadducees and were not particularly friendly toward the Pharisees, they got together and got a posse of the temple police officers to seize or arrest Jesus. And kind of illustrates something of the seriousness of the situation in the eyes of the authorities. This was a real problem, a big enough problem to send somebody to bring him in. And the arrest warrant, as it were, probably came from the Sanhedrin, the ruling body. And the temple police officers that are referenced here were Levites that were responsible to the Sanhedrin, because that was the way things worked politically. And again, the Sanhedrin is a formal ruling body of the Jews who had authority in a limited sense. They were under the Romans, so they had some authority, but their authority was limited by whatever the Romans would let them have. Therefore, they were a little concerned if they got too carried away that the Romans would take away some of their power, as had been previously noted as well. They would find Jesus to be more elusive than anticipated. That is, those who came to get him. We recognize that Jesus' hour had not yet come, and this is noted in different words, because he had not come to the place of his hour arriving. And the Jews would search for him at a time in the future and would not be able to find him because the timing would have elapsed by that point. And he was going to where they could not come, namely to heaven, and death was not the end. There were two options, either heaven or hell. And they could not come to where he was going because of their present unsaved condition. That would require regeneration and translation. And time was running out, both for Jesus to finish his work, which was coming in due time, and for the Jews to believe on him, which would have been a concern that would have been on the mind of Jesus. The Jews only had a little while longer to place their faith in him before Jesus would be crucified and then be raised from the dead and then ascend to heaven and be no longer around. So he was essentially referencing what was going to be taking place in the future. It's also interesting that after Jesus was off the scene, many of the Jews were doing exactly what Jesus said. They are searching for the Messiah and not finding him, because he had already come and they missed him. But they're still searching. You're searching and you're not going to find him. And that has been going on ever since for those who have not accepted him as the Messiah. His point to them was that they were not in control of the situation. There was divine timing involved in this process. Then looking at verses 35 and 36, then the Jews said among themselves, where does he intend to go that we shall not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? What is this that he said, you will seek me and not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? So they're trying to make sense of that, trying to think of what context would fit this. They were obviously focused on the physical realm. Many will be surprised by what is predicted here. And that is, again, another understatement in that what Jesus is essentially predicting is going to be so monumental that time, as we know it, is marked by the events that take place because of his presence on earth. But again, the leaders were still focused only on the physical realm. And we've seen that at various times, and we tend to fall into that as well. Jesus' hearers thought that he was speaking of physical matters and earthly places. The dispersion, as we are well aware, refers to the Jews that are scattered from Palestine and were living elsewhere. I think of it at times. If you think about the Romans are now ruling over the land of Palestine or Israel, and there may have been those there at that time who said, well, if the Romans are leading here or are ruling us, then we're going to go to Canada. I mean, we're going to go to somewhere else. But you can relate to the picture. But also, there had been various other occasions that had caused them to move, like the diaspora, which is a different term. It talks about those that were spread from the Assyrian captivity and the Babylonian captivity. But there were more occasions that had led some to move out and live elsewhere, but that's what they were essentially referring to, those who were spread out around the larger regions of the world at that time. So they thought that maybe Jesus would be ministering to Jews or perhaps even Gentile proselytes that were living outside of Palestine. Well, if that was the case, then he would be moving on and he wouldn't be their problem anymore if they were to follow that kind of logic. But that probably is not what they ultimately were going to come to conclude. But he was anticipating what was going to be taking place. The departure of Jesus in death would be beneficial, but maybe not in the way that they would be thinking that it would. It would be beneficial because he's going to provide the salvation that they are in need of. And they will be thinking, if we could just get rid of him, get rid of this false Messiah, as they supposed, then their problems would be solved. But the word was going to spread to the Greeks, ultimately, because the apostles are going to, and other disciples are going to be spreading it around to the Greeks in the future. The Jews were confused and uncertain of Jesus' meaning. They did not understand where Jesus was going any more than they understood where he had come from. He was a difficult one for them to grasp. And it does cause one to try to imagine, if I had been there at that time and had seen Jesus and had heard him speak, would I have recognized him? Now, I'd like to think that I would, just because I'm just that smart. Well, you all know better than that. I would like to think that I would know, but would I have, had I been in that situation? Would I have been as blind and ignorant and misunderstanding as they were? But what happens is, and we have this today, our thinking is blinded by context that we find ourselves in, that we sort of make parameters around ourselves, and we can't think beyond that. And they sort of had done that in their thinking of what the Messiah should be like. and that caused them not to be able to see him. Unless they didn't have that box that they had built around their thinking. These people were not ready. Were not ready for what was going to take place. It was not the time for Jesus to be arrested at this time. They didn't know anything about what the timing should be, so it's not surprising, but it does point out that it was not under their control. It was under God's control. And they couldn't take Jesus until he was ready, according to God's timing. And it would not be very likely that they could have anticipated the crucifixion at this point, nor could they have anticipated his resurrection, nor could they have anticipated his ascension. What would have given them an idea that all of that was going to transpire in a very short amount of time and not that long after this, and that Jesus would be back up in heaven? And it is exactly what he was predicting at this point. Well, it does go to show us how easily people can be deceived, self-deceived, living within our own little box that contains our own thinking, become resistant to the truth because it doesn't fit their expectations. And when we see and communicate and talk with other people, we find they are struggling with the same kind of problems. They have a box around their thinking that limits them, and we need to help communicate truth in such a way that we can get through that, and by the Spirit's conviction in the process. This requires patient understanding in our dealing with people, and it's also a warning not to fall into the same kind of trap of judging by appearances that we have conceived in our own head and that things don't fit the way we think it ought to be. And so we need to understand the whole of Scripture in its larger context and not miss the truth that it is presenting. And we need to be careful to make proper judgments regarding the truth of who Jesus is and what he has done, because he is the Messiah, the Savior, the King, and we can trust in him and entrust ourselves to him.